So imagine you have this crystal ball, right?
Okay.
And you can predict tomorrow's inflation data perfectly. Like, you know the exact headline number the government is going to publish before anyone else on Earth does.
That's the dream, right?
Right. So you place your trade based on this infallible information, and the data comes out exactly as you foresaw. But by the end of the day, you've somehow lost millions of dollars. Your whole portfolio is just decimated.
Yeah, which sounds completely counterintuitive, but it happens all the time.
Exactly. And welcome to today's deep dive. Today, we're digging into a really intense, highly strategic report. It's called Hedge Fund Style Investing in the United States, and it was put together by the financial researchers over at the American newspaper and American TV.
Yeah, it's a fascinating read.
It really is. And our mission today is to figure out why, knowing the future doesn't actually guarantee you make money. We want to look at how the world's most elite money managers actually read the economy.
Because, I mean, that scenario you just described is the perfect starting point for this. For a hedge fund manager, just studying macroeconomic data as like an academic exercise, it's completely useless.
Right.
Like memorizing GDP growth rates or pinpointing the consumer price index, that doesn't actually generate returns. That raw data only becomes valuable when you connect it to the actual mechanics of the market.
Which means looking at what exactly?
Cash flows, discount rates, risk premiums, and crucially, how other investors are currently positioned.
Okay, so we're basically throwing out the standard finance textbook today. We're looking at what happens when the future collides head-on with human behavior, massive amounts of leverage, and just shifting price tags.
Exactly. To understand how these funds operate, we first have to completely change our mental model. We have to stop consuming economic news the way everyday investors do.
Yeah, and the report makes a really sharp distinction right up front between a forecast and a trade. Because a forecast is just looking at the landscape and saying, inflation will decline next quarter.
Which is really just an observation.
Right.
A trade goes several steps further into the actual mechanics. A trade forces you to ask, well, if inflation declines, is that decline already priced into the front end of the Treasury yield curve?
Oh, wow.
Right. And if the decline actually happens, how is that going to compress real yields? Will it weaken the US dollar against the euro or the yen? It's an entirely different level of rigorous questioning.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy because I think it helps. Having a forecast is basically like knowing it's probably going to rain,
Sure.
but having a trode is realizing that, well, everyone in town has already bought an umbrella, so buying stock in the umbrella company right now, even though it's definitely going to rain.
Is a terrible idea.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea because there are no new buyers left. Like, the good news is already maxed out in the price.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
And to take that umbrella concept from just a theoretical idea to actual execution, managers rely on what the report calls the four questions.
Okay, lay those out for us.
First, what changed? So that could be an economic release, maybe a shift in central bank policy, or even just a shift in market psychology.
Right, something triggers it.
Exactly. Second, what is already priced into the market? Third, what specific financial instrument expresses this view the best? Because you could trade an inflation view using equities or options, government bonds, currencies, and each one has a different cost to hold.
So you have to pick the right vehicle.
Right. And then the fourth question, which is so crucial, is the falsification trigger. Basically, what kills the trade?
I want to linger on that last one, actually, because it ties into what the source calls the practical macro transmission map.
Yeah, that map is key.
Because it starts with economic inputs, right?
Yeah.
Like inflation, labor data, which then dictate policy and liquidity. And then that policy shifts market prices, which finally dictates how hedge funds act. But I'm still hung up on my crystal ball scenario from the start.
Where you had the perfect forecast but still lost money.
Yeah. If I know the exact input, why am I bleeding cash?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the text breaks that exact failure down into three layers of analysis: forecast, factor, and flow.
Okay.
You nailed the forecast layer with your crystal ball, but the factor layer is the underlying risk driving your position. Like you might buy a tech stock thinking you're betting on lower inflation, but mathematically, you're actually just taking on broad market momentum risk.
Interesting. So you're betting on the wrong thing without realizing it.
Exactly. But the flow layer is where it gets truly ruthless. Flow analysis asks who currently owns this trade, and more importantly, who might be forced to sell it.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. So if your brilliant inflation trade is overcrowded, and a sudden shock somewhere else in the market forces massive funds to raise cash, they're going to sell the exact same assets you're holding.
So you lose money not because your forecast was wrong,
but because forced selling just completely overwhelmed the fundamentals.
Wow. The mechanics of forced selling just hijack the whole fundamental value.
Yeah.
Okay, so since we're establishing that the market isn't about predicting the news, but it's a mechanism for measuring what is already priced in, we need to look at the baseline. The ground floor used to price literally everything else in the financial world.
Right, the very bottom layer.
Because according to the learning sequence in our source report, stage one isn't, you know, analyzing tech stocks or oil. It's the price of money itself.
The price of money, specifically the risk-free rate, is the base discount rate for every single risky asset on the planet.
And the report highlights instruments like treasury bills and SOFR.
Yeah, SOFR, the secured overnight financing rate, which is essentially the benchmark interest rate that massive financial institutions use to borrow cash from each other overnight and secured by treasuries.
So if you don't understand SOF...
If you don't understand the dynamics of SOR and government bond yields, you literally cannot accurately price a corporate bond or a barrel of oil. You're flying blind.
The authors are super uncompromising about real rates, too. We know real rates dictate valuation multiples and, like, even the price of gold.
Mm.
But I really want to look at how hedge funds actually trade the yield curve.
Oh, the yield curve strategies are wild.
Yeah. Figure 2 in the report dives into this, comparing short-term interest rates to long-term rates. And the big takeaway for me was that the overall level of rates matters way less than the actual shape of the curve.
Absolutely.
And the exact same visual shape on a chart can mean two completely opposite economic realities.
Let's look at the mechanics of a steepener, for example.
Okay, explain what that is first.
So a steepener is just when the gap between short-term rates and long-term rates widens. But a manager has to structure their trades completely differently depending on the cause.
Right.
So you have a bull steepener, which happens when front-end rates fall rapidly. This is usually because the market expects the central bank to panic cut rates to save a struggling economy.
So to trade that, what do they do?
A hedge fund would go heavily long on short-term bonds, like the 2-year treasuries, basically betting their price will surge as their yields collapse.
Okay, but then you have a bear steepener, which looks similar on a chart, right? But it requires a totally different strategy.
Totally different. A bear steepener happens when long-end rates rise violently. And this isn't driven by central bank cuts. It's usually driven by the market just becoming terrified of massive government fiscal deficits or, you know, runaway long-term inflation.
So people demand more money to hold long-term debt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Investors demand higher yields to hold 10-year or 30-year bonds. So to profit from a bear steepener, a fund wouldn't be buying short-term bonds at all. They'd be aggressively shorting long-term bonds.
Betting that their prices will plummet as their yields skyrocket.
Right. The shape is the exact same, but the engine driving it and the financial instrument you use to exploit it is entirely different.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, though, because I'm struggling to see how this beautiful, highly rational pricing model survives in a true panic.
It doesn't always.
Right. Because if the risk-free rate is the gravity of the financial world pulling on the valuation of everything, the report treats liquidity like the atmosphere. It's the necessary lubrication.
Yeah, it's the oil in the engine. It's simply the ability to buy or sell something without causing a massive price impact.
But if that oil drains out, doesn't the whole theoretical gear system just completely seize up?
It seizes up violently.
Mm.
When liquidity is abundant, the gears spin flawlessly. Risk premiums compress, managers feel super safe using higher leverage, and those crowded trades we talked about persist.
But when it drains out?
When it drains out of the system, bid-ask spreads widen. And the bid-ask spread is just the gap between the highest price a buyer is willing to pay and the lowest price a seller will accept.
Which is usually tiny, right?
Yeah. In a liquid market, that gap is pennies. But in an illiquid market, it becomes a massive canyon. The fundamental cost of simply getting out of a trade just skyrockets.
It's like the toll booth to exit the highway suddenly costs your entire life savings.
That is exactly what it's like. And this reveals the great illusion of diversification, which the report talks about.
Oh, yeah. Explain that.
So a manager might look at their portfolio and think, hey, I'm perfectly insulated. I've got a mix of emerging market stocks, municipal bonds, physical commodities.
Sounds safe.
Right. But when liquidity evaporates, correlations spike to 1.
Which basically means?
It's a statistical way of saying the math breaks down and every single asset drops at the exact same time. Everyone rushes to convert their holdings into U.S. dollars simultaneously.
Wow.
So that beautifully diversified portfolio just merges into one giant, highly correlated macro risk.
So if liquidity can vanish that violently, destroying all the baseline math, how do these funds actually survive that environment?
It depends on the machine they've built.
Right, because the report provides this incredible strategy sensitivity matrix in Figure 3. It shows how different types of funds navigate this stuff. Instead of just listing them off, let's put them through a stress test.
Okay, I like that.
Let's introduce a sudden, massive spike in interest rates across the globe. How does that damage ripple through these different strategies? Let's start with global macro funds.
Well, if we hit the system with an interest rate shock, the global macro funds are kind of the first line of defense. They trade the biggest picture items, currencies, rates, central bank policy.
So they should theoretically profit from this shock?
Theoretically, yes. But their inherent vulnerability is timing. A global macro manager might have correctly predicted that rate spike, but maybe they put the trade on 6 months too early.
Oh, man. So they're just sitting there waiting.
And bleeding money. They bleed money paying the cost to hold those positions, and their investors might literally force them to close the trade right before they're proven correct.
So they survive the shock but die of exhaustion waiting for it to happen.
Exactly.
Okay, what about long-short equity managers? They're deep in the weeds of, like, corporate balance sheets. They aren't trying to guess the Fed's next move, right?
Right. They focus on things like earnings, operating leverage, which is how a company's fixed costs magnify their profit or loss. Like, if a software company has massive fixed server costs, a tiny drop in subscriptions can completely wipe out their profit margin.
So the equity manager thinks they're insulated because they're shorting companies with terrible operating leverage and buying ones with great cash flow.
But the macro gravity crushes them anyway. When our theoretical interest rate shock hits, the discount rate applied to future earnings just skyrockets.
Ah, right.
So those long-short managers will see the valuation multiples of their favorite high-growth tech stocks completely collapse. The individual company might report fantastic earnings, but the stock price plummets anyway because the fundamental cost of money changed.
That is brutal. Okay, then you have event-driven strategies. These are the folks looking at corporate mergers, spin-offs, antitrust risks.
Yeah, they trade deal spreads. That's the difference between a company's current stock price and the price a buyer has agreed to pay to acquire them.
So how does our rate shock hit them?
It's devastating for them because corporate mergers are funded by debt.
Oh, of course.
Right. So when rates spike unexpectedly, the cost to finance a multi-billion-dollar acquisition becomes totally prohibitive. Banks pull their funding, deals collapse, the deal spreads blow out, and these event-driven funds take heavy instantaneous losses on transactions they thought were legally guaranteed to close.
Which leaves us with the systematic strategies.
Right.
The CTAs or commodity trading advisors.
Also known as managed futures.
Right. And these algorithms don't read the news. They aren't sitting around debating inflation theory or reading corporate balance sheets. They're just designed to capture durable price trends, right? They just ride the wave.
Exactly. But their vulnerability is the whipsaw.
The whipsaw.
Yeah. When a trend violently reverses direction without any warning, the algorithms are caught leaning the wrong way. They're forced to aggressively buy high and sell low as their risk parameters trigger automatic liquidation.
So they take massive losses during the pivot before they can figure out the new trend.
Right. They survive the trend, but the sudden pivot kills them.
I want to look at the physical building blocks of the economy in this scenario, too. Things like oil and gold. Because the report treats their mechanics very differently in the face of a macro shock.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, oil is what the report calls a path-dependent macro asset.
Meaning what?
Meaning the reason the price is moving matters way more than the movement itself. If the price of oil rallies because factories are running hot and global consumer demand is booming, that's a risk-on signal. The economy is expanding.
But what if it's not demand?
Right. If oil spikes simply because of a supply shock, like a geopolitical crisis shutting down a shipping lane, that is a risk-off signal. It acts like a massive regressive tax on every consumer and corporation on Earth, and it drags the whole economy toward recession.
And gold operates in a totally different mechanical universe, doesn't it?
Completely different.
Yeah.
Gold is a monetary asset with zero cash flow. It pays no dividend. It produces no earnings.
Right.
And because of that, it is hypersensitive to real interest rates and the strength of the U.S. dollar. It serves as this classic hedge against policy errors.
So when things go wrong,
when investors lose confidence in fiscal stability, or when inflation outpaces interest rates and drives real yields into negative territory, gold surges. It's basically pure financial defense.
Okay, so we've got all these incredibly complex machines. The macro funds bleeding out early, the equity funds getting crushed by multiples, the trend followers getting whipsawed. Every single one of them has a fatal flaw.
They do.
So the mark of an elite hedge fund isn't just generating brilliant ideas, right? It's knowing exactly how those ideas will try to kill you and surviving anyway.
Survival is the only metric that matters at that level. And the primary tool they use to ensure that is the pre-mortem.
Because expected returns are, like, mathematically irrelevant if you experience a drawdown severe enough to put you out of business.
Exactly. Before elite managers commit a single dollar to a trade, they execute a pre-mortem, systematically asking, what will make this fail? And they look far beyond just fundamental economic reasons.
It's like extreme defensive driving. It's like they aren't even looking at the destination anymore. They spend 90% of their time mapping out every single ditch, every pothole, and every reckless driver on the road.
That's exactly it. They're looking for technical landmines. They're asking questions like, well, what happens if our prime broker, you know, the massive investment bank that lends us money to trade, what if they suddenly increase our margin requirements overnight?
Right. Or what if the shares you borrowed get recalled?
Exactly. What if the specific shares we borrowed to short a company are suddenly recalled by the original owner and we're forced into a catastrophic short squeeze?
And the report specifically warns about the danger of a crowded long position, too. Like, who owns the trade?
That is so important. If every major hedge fund already owns a stock because the fundamental thesis is so obvious, the asset can actually plummet on good news.
Wait, really? Because the news is good.
Right. But when the positive earnings report finally hits, there are no new buyers left to drive the price up. Everyone's already in. So instead, everyone tries to take profits at the exact same moment.
Turning what should have been a massive victory into a massive sell event.
Yep. Exactly. And leverage is the ultimate magnifier here. Leverage allows funds to amplify their returns by borrowing capital, but it fundamentally alters the math of survival.
Because it turns simple, everyday market volatility into, like, terminal solvency risk.
Yes. You can take a relatively safe, low volatility asset, apply 10 times leverage to it, and suddenly a routine 2% price fluctuation triggers a margin call that wipes out your entire fund.
Which is why the central professional habit highlighted in the report is so uncompromising. You must size your position smaller when uncertainty is high or when market liquidity is poor, no matter how attractive your core thesis might be.
You have to. Yep. And the risk teams even utilize a concept called the liquidity waterfall to enforce this.
Oh, I love this part. Explain the waterfall.
The liquidity waterfall is this rigorous stress testing mechanism. Risk officers literally bucket every single asset in the portfolio based on how fast it can be turned into cash.
Okay.
So cash and treasury bills are in the immediate safest bucket. Highly liquid, large cap equities are in the next one. And then they move all the way down to complex, bespoke derivatives and distressed high yield bonds at the very bottom.
So they're preparing for a run on the bank.
Exactly. The risk officer simulates a crisis, asking, if our investors panic and demand 30% of their money back tomorrow, will we have enough liquid assets to pay them? Or will we be forced to sell our most illiquid complex assets into a market where there are no buyers?
Because forced selling is where a difficult month turns into a total fund collapse. Like, you see funds using instruments like variance swaps where they aren't even betting on the direction of the market. They are literally just trading the mathematical difference between expected volatility and actual realized volatility.
Right. And those instruments are incredibly complex and highly illiquid during a crash. The highest level portfolio rule from the text is absolute here. Never let one scenario, one funding source, one crowded trade, or one hidden factor determine the survival of the fund.
Which is so critical.
It really is. And this raises an important question, right? How often do everyday investors or even, like, subpar institutional managers confuse a hidden liquidity beta for actual alpha?
Let's define that really quick. Alpha being pure, unadulterated investing skill that outperforms the market without taking on extra risk. While beta is just riding the broader market wave.
Exactly. It is incredibly easy to look like a visionary genius when you're simply taking on massive, hidden leverage in a calm, highly liquid market. Your returns look fantastic.
Everyone looks like a genius in a bull market.
Right. It's only when the regime changes or the liquidity drains from the system that you find out who actually built a robust, mathematically sound portfolio.
Yay.
And who was just recklessly leveraged on a crowded trade, hoping the music wouldn't stop.
Man, that is the ultimate lesson from this deep dive, isn't it? It's not that you, the listener, need to run out and start trading variance swaps or trying to predict the consumer price index to the third decimal point.
No, definitely not.
The true realization here is about the framework of elite decision making. It's about measuring what is already priced into the expectations of the crowd around you.
Identifying your hidden exposure.
Yes. Ruthlessly questioning your factor risks and building in a massive margin of safety for when the rules of the game suddenly invert.
It requires a total shift in perspective. You must abandon the desire to be a perfect forecaster and instead become a master of preparation and survival. You have to internalize that the market is rarely reacting to the news itself.
It's reacting to the delta between the news and what the collective crowd already expected. Which leaves you with a final thought to chew on today. If elite hedge funds survive by constantly demanding a pre-mortem, mapping out their vulnerabilities, and obsessively asking, what does the consensus already expect? Right, how could you apply that exact framework to the decisions in your own life?
It's a great question.
Right. Whether you are walking into a room to negotiate a salary, deciding the terms of a mortgage, or even just deciding how much anxiety to feel over today's scary news headlines, are you blindly reacting to the forecast? Or are you looking at what's already priced in?
You have to know what's priced in.
Because the pristine blueprint of how things should work, it doesn't exist. You have to ensure you aren't the one caught in the collision when the future actually arrives. Keep asking what's priced in, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.